Think you know fantasy basketball? You can win money with FanDuel tonight and all through the NBA playoffs. Draft your fantasy basketball team for tonight's playoff action. It's quick and easy, and you could win huge cash prizes. Sign up for FanDuel now using promo code LINEUPS and get a $5 bonus with your first deposit. Just visit FanDuel.com or download the FanDuel app. Then draft your NBA playoff team and play for cash. Again, make sure to use the promo code LINEUPS when signing up. Do it now so you can win on the games tonight. You're listening to SpursCast, episode 543. My name is Paul Garcia, and I am the host of SpursCast. Joining me in studio for this SpursCast episode is Project Spurs' Colin Reed. Colin, how you doing, man?
I'm doing pretty good. How about yourself?
Doing pretty well. You know, the Spurs are now, obviously, as we know, they're out of the playoffs. They came up short in Game 7. It was a very controversial ending to that Game 7. They made it very memorable, not in a very positive way. But, you know, SpursCast listeners, I asked Colin in here, you know, to come to the studio and record this off-season episode because this is basically the introduction to the off-season where he and I are going to basically wrap up this season and then kind of go into the off-season, looking at a lot of the cap situation, the contracts, you know, who do we think is going to get traded, you know, who might the Spurs look at signing? Those kind of questions are going to try to answer here in this episode. So let's go ahead and begin, Colin, with the... what happened on Saturday night? The Spurs played in Game 7 in Denver. They lost barely 90-86. This was a game that Denver basically controlled most of the night. Spurs really didn't have a chance there until the last like 5 minutes. So, well, I'll give you a quick recap, should I say? So in the first quarter, the Spurs come out not playing well. Denver comes up is up by 13 pretty early with 3 minutes left. They end up winning the first quarter by 10 points. San Antonio was held to 13 points on offense. In the second quarter, Denver kind of they're pretty comfortable with the 7-13 point lead. They go into the halftime up by 13. Third quarter, much of the same. Denver leads by 12-17 points, pretty comfortable again. They lead by 11 after the third. However, it's the fourth where the Spurs play their best defense. They hold Denver to 18 points in the quarter. With 52 seconds left, the Spurs find themselves down by 2, so Denver calls timeout. With 36 seconds left, Jamal Murray hits a 14-foot floater. And that puts up puts the Nuggets up 90-86, which is going to end up being the final score. With 28 seconds left, DeMar DeRozan kind of drives to the left toward a crowd. He gets blocked by Torrey Craig. Jokic gets the rebound with 25 seconds left, and this is where it all comes down to the big moment that a lot of people were talking about, which was that with 25 seconds left, the Spurs had a chance to foul and, you know, basically make it a free throw type game and, you know, give themselves more possessions. And there you see Aldridge. Jokic is holding the ball up top. And Aldridge is so far away from him, like, you know, 2 to 3 feet away, kind of just, you know, waiting. And then there's Coach Pop on the sideline screaming at him, you know, foul him, foul him. You see Patty Mills gesturing to foul. You see DeRozan start pointing, Brent Forbes. But none of the guards and wings, they never actually go up there and try to foul him to help out Aldridge. And so, you know, eventually Pop's, like, animated on the sidelines. But then eventually, like, he just knows that, you know, Denver's basically running out of time. So he kind of just starts walking toward the bench. And then, of course, Denver, you know, with the last few seconds, they do have to take the shot. So Murray takes the 26-foot footer. He misses it. However, that's basically the ball game. Because once he shot that shot, there was only 4 seconds left. So the Spurs basically wasted 21 seconds. And obviously, we know what happens. Denver ends up winning the game. And everyone's just, like, in shock. Like, what in the world happened to San Antonio? This veteran team that was supposed to have all this experience. So they ended up losing. So kind of just, what were your initial thoughts on that game?
Yeah, I guess, you know, I was surprised that it was close at the end after seeing how poorly they played on offense. You know, the Nuggets are a team where they can play poorly on offense for 3 quarters like we saw in game 2 and then turn it on in the last quarter. And it just seems historically, and maybe someone knows the numbers or something and this isn't true, it just seems like when the Spurs are shooting poorly or they have a bad offensive night, that's kind of consistent throughout the whole night. That's just kind of the feel I've had from this team forever. Like, it's really kind of always been that way. They're either, like, clicking or they're not. And so it was one of those games where it's like, okay, they're not clicking. There's not much they can do. Thought it'd be over. I think you always want to give yourself a chance, but I think the most important thing for anyone to remember, and this isn't going to be a whole lot of comforting to a lot of people, is that even in those situations, it's a low percentage chance you even win anyway, because now, and I know they're a young and experienced team or whatever, now you're hoping for players to miss free throws for you to even have a chance. And then you have to go back and probably hit a three and like, okay, so like who on the Spurs are we saying like we're going to give this to them and they're going to hit a three for sure? And I mean, I know they've had shooters that have shot well, but like, again, we talk about volume. They had shooters out there, but just because that volume is so low, and again, it had been such kind of an off and on shooting night, it's one of those things where you think like, what if, what if, what if? But if they would have fouled, like the odds of them winning are still so low. So it was one of those kind of rough games, and it almost is just a testament to who this team is that they made it. Kind of a microcosm of their whole season.
Yeah, for
sure. They did real poorly for a lot of the game. They were down a lot of the game, and somehow they found themselves in it. Which kind of is how the whole season was.
Yeah, no, for sure. It kind of encapsulates, you know, like you just said, encapsulates them. What I was really really surprised by in a way was that, like, you know, after game six, I had to do the Spurs cast on myself, and I basically said, you know, this is what the Spurs need to win game seven. They need Denver to miss threes, to not shoot a lot of threes, take away the three ball, make it a 2-point contest, but you need somebody else to help LaMarcus and DeRozan. So the Spurs got two of those three wishes. They got the help. They got Rudy Gay 21 points, Bryn Forbes 19 points, and they also got the help on defense. They took away Denver's threes. Nuggets only shot 2 of 20 from three, just 6 points from the 3-point. That's all they got, and yet they still lost. And why is that? You know, you have to look at the two leaders, which are DeRozan and Aldridge. They had a terrible game, like you mentioned. You know, just from the start, they were real cold. You could tell they're in the first quarter. So they end up combining the Spurs' go-to players, the two go-to guys, end up shooting 13 of 37 combined, 35% for 35 points. So way more shots taken than points scored. 10 assists combined and 4 turnovers. And then, you know, you can look at their kind of like X-factor we've said all series, which is Derek White. And obviously he is a young player, and like you and I had talked about, you can't expect him to score 20 a night. It's just not who he is at this point. Maybe he will be one day, but right now in this series, sure, he scored 36 one night. That's just not who he is. And you saw there, he was 0 of 7 from the floor, and Pop basically went with experience. He went with the guy he thought, you know, if the ship was going to go down on Saturday night, he was going to go down with the player that he trusts more. And at this stage, it's Patty Mills, because Patty Mills played the entire fourth quarter. Now, some fans were upset about that, but, you know, White hadn't made a shot all night. So, I mean, and he never did. So you know, it was just another factor where, you know, he was a young player. Maybe he got caught up in the moment. We don't know. So yeah, they ended up losing. I don't want to spend too much time on that game because it does end their season, but I do want to move forward a little bit. Let's go into the second topic, and that's kind of looking at some trends that we saw on this team on both sides of the ball, on offense and on defense, that kind of carried over both in the regular season and then into the playoffs. So let's first go to the offense. Two of the stats that I really found here that they really had trouble were the non-corner threes. In the regular season, we saw them shoot 38%, second in the league, you know, one of the best accurate teams from three in that area. However, that dipped all the way down to 33% in the playoffs. And one thing we saw that Denver did to the Spurs was they took out their good 3-point shooters. You know, they took away Bellinelli, they took away Bertans, Patty Mills, and you know, eventually those guys did kind of get it together in Game 6 and 7, the shots at least, but they couldn't make them. They were just so out of rhythm. So what did you think about that? The fact that like the Spurs, we know they don't shoot a lot of threes, and they were still like the most accurate team this whole season, but then Denver just easily in one series devised a game plan to take away those the one strong part of their 3-point shooting.
Yeah, I was actually thinking about this for something else earlier, but it works here too. Stan Van Gundy was on the Low Post yesterday.
Oh, I didn't even listen to that one. Yeah,
yeah, he was given this like very coaching centric view of the playoffs, and he had mentioned a couple things that were really interesting. But one of them that really stuck with me is that matchups are more important than like schematic stuff. So we like do all this time to be like, oh, what big adjustment are they going to make? What are they going to change on defense or whatever? But like the matchups are even more important than that. And really, the Nuggets changing some of their matchups mid-series really changed a lot of it. Torrey Craig coming to the starting lineup, being put on Derek White. You mentioned him. That really shut him down.
Harris. Yeah. Harris. Yeah. Craig guarded DeRozan, though.
Yeah. And he guarded DeRozan really well. But I think that they just kind of found those right matchups for a lot of the time. I know a lot going back to scheme, though, you know, they were, again, well-documented, running their shooters off of the three-point line, just not giving them clean looks. So it's one of those things where, you know, it probably was that they weren't taking the same in rhythm, clean looks that they had when they were hitting the second highest mark in the league. So, you know, and I think part of that comes to when you're not basing your offense around something, it's probably easier to take it away.
Yeah,
you know, when it's just a smaller aspect of your offense rather than like your whole offense is based around it. You don't have the counters required to like, okay, they took this away. Now how do we counter the counter?
Yeah.
It's just like, okay, well, it's such a small part of our offense anyway. They took it away, and now what do we do?
Yeah, so no, that's a good point. And also, I think Coach Pop should get some credit there too, because for games 1 through 5, he was playing a lot of Davis Bertans. Then we saw him cut Davis's minutes altogether in games 6 and 7. And so what did that do? That allowed more guard-oriented lineups, and that helped slow down the Nuggets' three-point shooting, because their volumes significantly went down in games 6 and 7, and also their accuracy. So I think Pop also, but it was obviously, it wasn't enough, though, just to take away Denver's shooting. The other stat, though, that I want to talk about is frequency from threes. Now, we know this is the NBA, today's game, where it's all three-point shooting. You know, if not, you're considered like a dinosaur, like the Spurs, who don't take a lot of threes. So let's talk about their volume. Frequency from all threes. In the regular season, they were 30th. Only 27% of their shots came from three. In the playoffs, it went all the way down to 21% of their shots came from three, which is 16th, which is last among all playoff teams. So my question to you is, can they survive like this, like, next season and going forward, like, just being dead last in frequency? I know that during the regular season, they get the most accurate three-point shots. You know, DeRozan sets these guys up well. But I mean, I just feel like it always feels like they're behind in the math game. What do you think about that?
I mean, I would imagine they don't think they can survive like that. Because, you know, we hear in Pop's like postseason interview, he's talking about players shooting more threes, you know, and that's he even mentions Aldridge, he mentions DeRozan.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So when Pop is conceding that point, I think that we can say they know that they can survive like this. They know that that's kind of one of their undoings here. So I feel like we have it on pretty good authority that no, they can't, but it's hard. You know, there have been players who throughout their career have become better three-point shooters.
Yeah.
But you can't just expect, because someone's going to work on something, that they're going to get there. So it's one of those things where we can't count on that happening until next season. We see one of these guys actually hitting more threes or taking more threes even.
Yeah, and think about that too, is I just can't realistically see that, like, in terms of volume. Like, I can see them maybe taking one or two a game, like, spot-up type threes. But I can't see, like, just like DeRozan coming off the screen and pulling up for a three-pointer, or Aldridge, you know, being like Kevin Love, immediately going to pick and pop from three, just so fat, so quick. I just don't see that in terms of a one-year progression, just going, you know, over a summer to get that type of volume that we see from a lot of stars in today's NBA. So I think that's the really tough part for San Antonio. It's the fact that it's not just that you know, their role players are the shooters, have to be the shooters, should I say. It's the fact that they're two go-to guys that's just not in their game. I mean, and you even hear stuff like Pop had to say about LaMarcus, that he just doesn't like to play at the three-point line. He prefers to, you know, post it up, and it's like, yeah, but, you know, you see what's going on here. And so, I don't know, it's an interesting question, and we're going to kind of talk about, it's going to lead toward one of our topics as we go a little bit further into this episode, when we talk about the off-season plans. Let's look at the defensive end now, some trends I saw. You know, defense was still bad in the regular season. They allowed teams to score 112 points for 100. In the playoffs, that went up to 113, so just a one points per 100 difference. But again, it's going in the wrong direction. Half court defense was bad again, 95 in the season, up to 97.1 for Denver in the playoffs. And then accuracy at the rim was pretty consistent. They weren't very good there. Allowed 63% of the season, 62% of the playoffs. And then accuracy from the non-corner threes, 36% of the season to 36% in the playoffs. So on the defensive end, do you feel like this is something where DeJounte is really just going to help overall ease a lot of these weaknesses?
Yeah, I think that having someone where the point of attack is going through a defender like DeJounte will help. And you know, you think about what we talked about inserting Torrey Craig into the lineup did. And then you could shift Gary Harris over to Derek White, and now Torrey Craig is on DeRozan. And now the Spurs will kind of have that effect where they have Derek White, DeJounte Murray, and DeRozan. Now you can hide DeRozan on the weakest one through three.
Exactly.
And, you know, before it's like, sometimes that second option is still really good. Like, think about Portland or Golden State. You know, when the second best option is to hide DeRozan on someone who's still going to be really, really good, that's not as strong as hiding them on the third option. Like, if their third option is still insane, there's not a lot you can do about it. But a lot of the times, you're going to live with that. And I think that, again, we've seen it time and time before where players have improved just by being in the system longer. And so I think that's going to be the case for some of these players that are newer to the Spurs system. So I think, you know, having DeJounte, you know, just the plus minuses were insane 2 years ago. Just having him on the court versus having him off the court. and I had forgotten about that. I think that there's been a lot of pieces written about that. I think Jabari Young might have had one about, like, that might be their biggest offseason addition or whatever. But, you know, just to know, like, how much better they were with him on the court was about how good they were with Derek White on the court this year. So when he was off the court. So just adding that extra defender, I think, will help shift everything along.
Yeah, no, for sure. I'm with you there, too. Like, I just feel like having DeJounte and next to Derek White, you know, you improve a lot of these numbers. You're going to, like, let's just talk about accuracy at the rim. Okay, well, there's going to be less frequency from opponents because they're not going to beat those two guys as often toward the rim, getting into the rim and kind of carving up the Spurs' defense. The accuracy from the non-corner three, again, when you have better defenders out there, they're going to be quicker, you know, in rotating, just be a lot smarter, too, have a higher level IQ of knowing when to kind of tip passes and get into passing lanes and things like that. And I also think that him, you're going to increase your defensive rebounding. You're going to you know, your switchability, really. You're gonna, the only person you really have to worry about, if let's say that they all start, DeJounte, Derek, DeMar, LaMarcus, and Jakob, the only guys you really have to hide there is DeMar, like you mentioned. And so it's a lot easier when you just have one weak defender compared to when you had several, you know, that they can just target the defense. And also, he's going to give you more transition opportunities. You know, when he does get a defensive rebound, he can easily take it down court. So that should also increase the help out on their offense a little bit. So, yeah, I really feel like, you know, he is going to be a huge part of that. And I think the tough part for Pop will be is how much does having, if they do start that group, like I mentioned, how much does losing so much shooting on offense without, like, Bryn Forbes in there, how much is that going to weigh is what I think that the team will evaluate. Because I think that they'll definitely try it for, like, 20, 25 games, try it out, see how it goes. And if it's not working, they're just losing too many points in the offensive end. Right. They're just not scoring enough. Well, then maybe, yeah, you have to look at maybe sending one of those guys to the bench or, you know, making some more configurations. Let's go ahead and go into the offseason now. Let's go ahead and look at the Spurs' you know, cap situation, where they stand. So I'm going to go through each player's contract, and then I'll kind of go do the overview. So the highest paid player next season projected is DeMar DeRozan, earning $27.7 million. LaMarcus Aldridge is second, $26 million. Patty Mills third, $12.4 million. Davis Bertans fourth, $7 million. Marco Bellinelli fifth, $5.8 million. Jakob Poeltl sixth, $3.8 million. Bryn Forbes seventh, $2.9 million. The 19th pick, eighth, is going to earn $2.8 million. Lonnie Walker the fourth will also earn $2.8 million. DeJounte Murray will earn $2.3 million. Derek White will earn $1.9 million. The 29th pick will earn $1.9 million. And then Chimezie Metu will earn $1.4 million. As far as dead money on the Spurs' books, they have about $5 million bucks still from the Pau Gasol buyout that will be on their books. So with all cap holds right now, the Spurs are projected to be $18.8 million over the salary cap next year. Now, what does that do? That allows them to re-sign all their own free agents if they wanted to. And those free agents agreed, and it gives them access to the best MLE, which is worth $9.2 million. So while being over the cap this way, the Spurs would have access to add $9.2 million with the mid level exception. Now, what happens if, let's say, all the free agents sign elsewhere, or the Spurs just don't bring them back and they renounce their cap holds? Well, if that's the case, then they'd be $5 million under the cap, but they'd have a smaller exception. They'd only have the room exception, which is worth $4.7 million. So it's not as much money. So you know, if you're San Antonio and you're going to want to keep this group together, like Pop mentioned, then the best thing to do is try to re-sign your own free agents and use that $9.2 million cap hold. Now, the Spurs do have, you know, as long as there's no trades going down, there's 13 guaranteed players on the roster. They're, like I mentioned, they're going to be over the cap, and they're going to have Drew Eubanks on a 2-way deal. Looking at the free agents with cap holds, you got Rudy Gay with $13.1 million dollar cap hold. The Spurs can give him a 2 to 4 year deal at up to $19 million. You got Dante Cunningham $3 million, Pondexter $1.6 million, Mota Yunus $1.6 million, Joffrey LaVerne, even though he's not on the team, but since he's overseas, they have a cap hold $1.6 million. Nikola Milutinov, the 2015 first round pick, a $1.4 million cap hold, and then Ben Moore, the 2-way player, has a $1.4 million cap hold as well. So let's start here with Rudy Gay. What do you think is going to happen with him just initially?
So I could see him asking for, because obviously the Spurs can offer him the most. Well, not entirely true. They can offer him the most of, like, any over the cap.
They can offer him up to $19 million, basically.
Right. So
in one year of a deal.
Yeah. So anyone who can offer him more would have to be under the cap teams, and those teams I don't think are looking for Rudy Gay. So in practice, the Spurs will probably have more buying power for him than anyone else, really. But I don't think it's going to go the route of how much they can pay him. I think he might ask for something similar to what he's receiving now, maybe even a little less if it means a long-term deal.
Okay.
Something like a 3 or 4 year deal.
Yeah.
That way he has that security. You know, he's had a couple injuries in his career. You know, he's enjoyed his time in San Antonio. Maybe say, I'm going to play out the rest of my time while I'm still a player who can be useful to an NBA team with this team. Just lock me up for 3 or 4 years. And it might, like I said, be around what he's getting paid now, maybe a little bit more, a little bit less. But if I was Rudy Gay, I think that might be the route that I would take. And so I wouldn't be surprised if that came out. Or it could be like a 1 year, $19 million. You know? Yeah. I think either one of those are kind of feasible.
Yeah, for me, I've kind of gone back and forth. Ever since, I'd say, like, April, I've kind of just been back and forth. And, like, sometimes I feel like, yes, Rudy needs to be on the team. They're going to bring him back at all costs. Or sometimes I feel like, oh, this might be his last moment as a Spur. Kind of those kind of moments. It just feels – it's been really tough to read the situation here. You know, you see, like, when he's playing really well, he's scoring. You know, he's having some really good defensive moments, you know, being a switchy type defender. You know, that in the locker room, you know, he was like, one of the recipients of the Teammate of the Year award, mm-hmm. something like that. So, and just, like, all the guys really embraced him. You could just tell. And even Pop had some good remarks about him after the season ended and, you know, basically said that the Spurs do want to try to bring him back. And it just feels like he's really close to, like, LaMarcus and DeMar. And even, like, how they mentioned how he takes a lot of the young guys under his wing and really preps them. So, and you always see him, like, on social media with Patty Mills, like, they're doing the coffee club together and stuff. So I feel like to the part that's not a statistic, like those what do you call them, intangibles?
Yeah.
Those, I think that's a strong sign that he will resign here. I think he definitely likes it, the city, you know, the organization, like we said. However, the parts that I really, you know, some of the stuff that I have seen that might be a little negative is that the fact that, like, you know, how do we know that he doesn't like coming off the bench anymore? You know, how do we know that he wants to still be a starter? Maybe he doesn't like coming off the bench. We're not sure of that. It seems like they do play their best now, as we've seen with Jakob and LaMarcus together and Rudy. You know, and when he's coming off the bench, there's a lot more responsibility on him to produce. And we saw the results of that, like from games 2 through 5, he wasn't producing when he was coming off the bench. And, you know, and that's where you're looking for that help if you're LaMarcus and DeRozan and the Spurs. Whereas when game 6 and 7, when you see that he can produce and he gets it going, it's like, wow, you just added another weapon to your lineup. So I feel like there's a little bit more responsibility when he comes off the bench. You know, I've seen times during the season when Pop has immediately pulled him because he makes some terrible defensive mistakes. You know, so it's really hard to gauge. And from what I would just say right now is, I think you're right. I think he might look for the years. And I just feel like, you know, if the MLE is $9.2 million, which I think is what I think he can get from other teams, mm-hmm. then I think that the Spurs would just try to beat that by like $1 or $2 million more, maybe like a $10 to $11 million, like you were mentioning, like what he's kind of earning right now. So I really feel like I just can't read the situation quite well yet. So it wouldn't shock me. I mean, it wouldn't surprise me if he comes back, but then it also wouldn't shock me if he leaves. Is where I stand right now on Rudy Gay. Do you think they bring back Cunningham or Pondexter or Moditz?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, me either. So we don't spend any time on them. Milutinov is an interesting player. You know, it's hard to get the specific contract details of players overseas. I just know that most of the Spurs' international players, like Milutinov, Adam Hanga, Nemanja Dankovic, a lot of them do have buyouts every season. So that's kind of up to the Spurs and whether or not the player wants to come over and play. So from his perspective, I just don't know if like leaving, being a starting center, being one of the best players in the EuroLeague right now, if he would want to give that up just to come to the Spurs and be, you know, maybe be Jakob's backup, or do you just get the Pop rookie treatment as an international player? So what do you think about that?
Yeah, well, and the other thing that I'm thinking is if they start going, because we talked about the starting lineup looks good defensively, but we don't know offensively. And there's a couple of things that I'm actually thinking about that they could go a couple of different directions. One of them is to bring Rudy Gay, if they re-sign him, back into the starting lineup. And now Jakob's on the bench, and then what happens? Like, yeah. Now you have two centers in your rotation off the
bench.
And
you have Chimezie Metu still there.
Right, and so who gets the minutes, who gets to play, and now all of a sudden you have people playing inconsistent minutes, and maybe, like you said, someone who's in contention for the EuroLeague MVP is not even playing in the NBA. And so I think that's obviously something they're going to take into consideration, but just the way that their lineups are right now is so weird that I could see why it wouldn't make sense to come over to the NBA unless they had pretty good assurance that he would be that backup big.
Let's talk about trades a little bit. I almost feel like there's not really an untouchable player on this roster. Like, I just feel like everyone's up for grabs. Like, if a team caught it and they had a package that San Antonio would like, I think that they would execute a trade on mostly all these guys. So that's where I kind of just overall. But I think that the guys that are kind of safe, I guess you would say. But like I said, nobody's like untouchable. Is like DeRozan seems like a safe option right now. It's weird because I don't think, you know. First of all, I don't know what team's going to call for Patty Mills, but I just also don't think that. I just think that listening to Pop and his endorsement of him, it just sounds like he means so much more than just what the statistics provide or what he does on the court. I feel like the Spurs value his his leadership just so much more than maybe what we see on the box score each night. So I almost feel like Patty's not a guy who would possibly get traded. Jakob's obviously played well, and I don't think they would look at moving him. I'm interested to see your thoughts on Forbes. I almost feel like they wouldn't, unless it was a really, really good package for him. I don't think that they would. What do you think about that?
Like, yeah, so I think
it's like he's like the last reliable players in terms of a guard.
I honestly wasn't even thinking about the Spurs trading anyone until I saw Jeff McDonald talking about that on Twitter and on his personal podcast or whatever. What I realized about Forbes today is that, weirdly enough, like, he might be. You talk about the untouchables like Murray and White, as untouchable as they can be. Put those aside. After those two, he might be the Spurs' best trade chip just because of the contract that he's on. What he gave to the Spurs on a less than $3 million deal, that's a very easy contract to move. If the Spurs were looking to do some maneuvering for any sort of reason, like, that's the type of deal that works. But he wouldn't be a salary dump. Like, he's a player. But for that reason, that's a good reason to hold on to him. I think that he does help space the floor. And this is kind of going off. It's the same thing, but a slightly different direction. I think he could be important for the Spurs, if like 4 months into the season, we're looking and we're thinking the offense is just not doing anything. And it's not worth the defensive improvements. And we say, or the Spurs say, rather, they might give Derek White like the Ginobili treatment, because I think he loses so much of his offensive capabilities when he doesn't have the ball in his hands.
Yeah, for sure.
As much as he won't when,
and he's going to lose less touches next year with Murray.
Right, with Murray and DeRozan out there. Yeah. I feel like he can hit those spot up threes, but like, I feel like so much of what he does well is just run the pick and roll, steady the offense, and they're going to take the ball out of his hands so much that I feel like you're losing a lot of what he brings to the table in that starting lineup. So I can see a situation where they say, like, you're our first guard off the bench, but we're going to put Forbes back in the starting lineup to give some spacing, and now there's not going to be too many ball handlers.
Yeah,
and
no, for sure.
For that reason, I think Forbes might be important to keep around.
Yeah, for sure. And like, I was going to keep going down the list. Lonnie Walker doesn't look like a guy who would probably get traded unless there was something really astounding. DeJounte, like we mentioned. Derek White, like you mentioned. I think a guy who would be available would be like somebody like Chimezie Metu, who really has improved a lot. As far as the two picks, the 19th and 29th, I think the only way they get rid of those two picks is if they trade up. So, like, they package them together is kind of where I see them, those two picks. I don't think, since they're going to be an over-the-cap team, I don't see no urgency in why you would package one of those picks with one of these players you want to get off their contract. It just doesn't make any sense. Unless you had a commit from Kevin Durant or just somebody, really good all-star who was giving you their word that they were coming. Then, of course, you try to use those picks and trade. So those are kind of the players that I think are pretty safe, that I don't think that they're going to move. Now, three players that I didn't mention were LaMarcus Aldridge, Davis Bertans, and Marco Bellinelli. So I want to talk about these three guys and why I didn't mention their names. It's really not safe. Now, I think Aldridge will be safe in the end, but I really feel like maybe they do need to make some calls on him. Just kind of see what his value is, gauge the market. Because like I mentioned, it goes back to that math part where I think you can survive in today's NBA with one guy who doesn't take a lot of threes, not volume threes. And I think that guy has to be DeRozan because he does so much more where he's creating. He can create from the point of attack. Pop basically called him in his end of season interview their only driver this year, basically. That's what he called DeMar. So that works, though, still in today's NBA. Sure, DeMar takes the mid-range jumper at a high level, but he still gets the free throw line. He still creates for others. We saw, the stats were there all year where he was the number one guy and getting everybody their three-pointers. I'm not as, as high on LaMarcus in terms of just, when he has a bad night like we saw in Game 7, it really just, there's not much else. It's hard to get him going. You have to put in more pick and roll action. Defensively, he's very underrated. I think that he really brings a lot there. But if you can get like a package where you get some other versatile defenders there that you can put at the four or just slot in, then I think that there's still some there. What do you think about him in terms of them just making calls?
Yeah, and that's another thing I was thinking of in terms of lineups, is that obviously we know about Morey Ball, the rim being rim free throws and threes. And you can get efficient shots from DeRozan that aren't threes from the free throw line in the rim. And I think when you pair him with someone like Poeltl, who can set good screens and roll hard, Now all of a sudden, like, if you surround DeRozan and Jakob with a couple shooters, that is an incredibly efficient offense at that point.
Yeah.
It's harder to make that kind of thing with Aldridge and a guard that doesn't shoot and a couple of shooters, because at that point you're starting it just, especially when one of the main ways that Aldridge attacks is the post up. So that kind of, so I mean, I don't think you want to like say, oh, hey, he's our best scorer, and just because he's not efficient in the way of like the modern NBA. But I do see what you're saying. I think that, you know, even if it's just making calls and seeing like what kind of packages are out there to just kind of get their offense more flowing while also keeping their defense intact.
Like, it, obviously, they're two different players, but like if you could just combine Aldridge's defense with Kevin Love's offense, I mean, that's like the four that you want him to be. But unfortunately, you know, you just can't make him to that, and you can't make Kevin Love into that type of player either. So it's, you know, I'm not saying that they should trade him. I'm just saying that I just feel like stylistically, like it's just tough to win in today's NBA. And I think we witnessed that in this last series with two guys that are not high volume 3-point shooters. I think you can survive with one, like I mentioned, but not two. That's really tough. So you know, I do think though he's safe. I don't think that they would move him. And then the two guys though that I think that definitely are movable are Davis Bertans making $7 million and Marco Bellinelli. And again, two reasons why I say their names is because Bertans, we basically saw Pop take him out of the rotation. And especially if they bring Rudy Gay back, if they do, you know, bring Rudy Gay back, well then, you know, we saw that when push comes to shove, Pop's going to choose Gay over Bertans. You know, the guy who's more versatile brings a lot more on both ends. And so you basically saw Davis not playing those last two games. And then Bellinelli, the fact that, you know, we all know he's a minus on defense, you know, throughout the whole year. But then also the fact that in the playoffs, you know, they really, Denver really took away his biggest strength, which is the outside shooting. And he really had a tough time getting going. What do you think about those two players?
Yeah, I think those are other players that would make sense to again, maybe not like actively shop, but like see kind of what packages are available. Since the Spurs have two draft picks, and it's hard to know. I mean, I feel like, and this is something we kind of glossed over, it would be interesting for the Spurs to sign or to draft two players that they immediately put into their system, just because now we have the roster spots and that kind of complication. I would imagine that one of them would be like probably the later pick, like a draft and stash type thing.
Yeah.
If they use both picks, but you know, if they don't see anyone in that late 30 area that they are really interested in, I can see packaging either one of those players with a pick to either get that type of wing, and who knows how many of those are available, but just they could provide a little bit more of that 3-and-D style, or move up in the draft from that 29 spot to just a couple higher even on that front, where they have two picks but they're closer together by the end of that.
Yeah, no, for sure. So like I said, I don't think, you know, I think like we both said, I think they'll make calls and just see what, you know, what's the market on them. Even though I'm not sure, I don't know if anything will come through. Now, let's look, it's weird when you look at this team, you know, especially with Murray coming back. Now, let's look at team needs. You know, I'm going to give you the depth chart where it kind of stands in my opinion. You know, let's just say they start with the starting five, like we mentioned. The one is White, two is DeJounte Murray, three is DeMar DeRozan, four is LaMarcus Aldridge, five is Jakob Poeltl. So that's your starting five. Off the bench, you got Patty Mills backing up the point guard. You got Bryn Forbes now coming to the bench. Then you still have Bellinelli, you know, there. And then Davis Bertans and Chimezie Metu. Again, this is assuming Rudy Gay hasn't been re-signed or won't get re-signed. Then as your last option, you got Lonnie Walker the fourth as that extra wing. And I really feel like they need to get Lonnie some minutes. But I feel like when it, you know, in terms of who does Pop trust in the regular season, I feel like Bellinelli and Forbes and Mills still beat him for those kind of minutes. So what do you think that is the specific need? I wrote down like a backup defender, 3 and 4 kind, you know, or maybe a volume shooter, not a spot up shooter, a volume shooter, somebody who really puts up a lot of attempts off the bench, and a backup big, you know, if they don't trust Chimezie Metu. What do you think about that? What kind of position they need?
Yeah, that's interesting to shout this out again, but when you said volume, it made me think of Stan Van Gundy again on the low post. He was talking about... Yeah. As a coach, he worries less about the guys that come off the bench and shoot three on good attempts than he does the volume shooters, even if they're lower percentages, because you know they can come in and have a game where they hit like five or six threes.
Yeah.
And so just knowing like that's a coach's mindset, that stresses them out more, that puts more pressure on them. I think knowing, even if the Spurs have signed a player like that or trade for a player like that, even if they're not like 40% three-point shooter, even if it's lower than that, but they'll shoot those threes, now all of a sudden another opposing coach has a game plan for that. So I would agree, especially the wing and the forward.
Yeah.
That 2 through 4. But especially if you're going to do someone that's a shooting guard nominally, I would look at someone with some size. Mm-hmm. Because I do think that is kind of something that's... They have a lot of size in their starting guards.
Yeah.
And then, but Patty and Forbes are kind of, I think, can be taken advantage of in that way of bigger guards could probably go at them on offense. So I think anywhere from that 2 to 4 range, someone that's a little bit long and can hit threes, but that is, you know, the biggest commodity in the NBA right now.
That's what everybody wants, exactly, yeah. Those 3 and D wings. I know, you know, we talk about Bellinelli's defense, but it's like, you know, where are you going to find these kind of players? That's why I feel like you got to give Lonnie Walker some minutes. So I had basically let you know beforehand, you know, the Spurs do have this $90.2 million mid-level exception, and I want to see if you had any free agent targets. So I put together a list, and for Spurs casters, if you want to see that list, I put it over on analyzingtheleague.com. You can see the whole list of all the players broken down by position that I put there. And, you know, as I started, like, sifting through the list and really taking my time and saying, oh, okay, what kind of player, you know, what kind of free agent? First of all, thinking of the money-wise, you know, first, you know, okay, so $9.2 million. What kind of player could they get with this kind of money? And I only ended up on 2 names out of the whole list. For, like, let's say that defender who can play, like, the 3 and the 4. I landed on Trevor Ariza. Now, I really like him still because why? He's a good defender. He's a good, you know, he's not a volume three-point shooter, but he's a spot-up three-point shooter. But again, he brings you that defense. Now, and I think maybe you can get him for the MLE, but he still might command over double digits, what the Spurs don't have in terms of money. Now, if I'm Ariza, again, I don't know why I come to San Antonio. Am I guaranteed a starter spot there? Right now, it looks like I'm not. And then, maybe I'll come off the bench, but is there any guarantee that I'm ever going to move up to the starting lineup? Is that kind of thing? I feel like he can get a starting job on other playoff teams, on other contenders. Who did you have? Did you have anybody in mind for that defensive type of wing, but who can also shoot threes?
So it's hard because you look at the list and either those players don't exist or the Spurs are immediately priced out.
Or they're Klay Thompson and we know that, you know, yeah. We just know they're not coming to San Antonio.
Yeah, yeah, like the price tag is too high. So I kind of tried to look for one or the other.
Okay.
I was looking at, and this would not take the full MLE, so maybe you swing a couple of times. Again, this was something that, again, Jabari Young of The Athletic around the trade deadline talked about how the Spurs had been interested in Stanley Johnson in the past.
Yeah, I saw his name on there.
Hey,
yeah, he wouldn't take the whole. He'd probably take 3 to 5.
Right, right.
No, probably 3 million. His value is very low.
Yeah, there's no reason to believe he can instantly come in and be that contributor. But if the Spurs feel like in our system we can make him a better player, there's no reason not to take a shot on a player like that. A Wayne Ellington type who's been a consistent 3-point shooter at some point. You know, I know with the Heat he did that pretty well. He did not play. Actually, honestly, don't know if he played at all this season because of injury, but Lukumba Mute had that season with the Houston where he defended.
And he was on my list in terms of that defensive guy off the bench, but I don't know if he ends up being like Dante Cunningham, kind of player, because the fact of the injury, it basically kept him out all year. He never got to. Yeah. So we don't know where his physically state is at and if he can get back to being, you know, when he was at Houston, he was pretty good that last year. So I think, yeah, I had his name too written down, but then I erased it because of that fact, injury.
Yeah, yeah. All of the guys that I'm looking at are not like absolutely what you're looking for. They're almost kind of like chances at that player.
Yeah.
Like, you know, we'll sign this player and see if he turns out to be this player, but there's a good chance that now those three are the Dante Cunningham and Quincy Pondexter that are leaving after 1 year. So it's one of those where I don't see any sure shots in there. I just see some maybe like chances where they can hope that guy maybe becomes that person in their system, but no guarantees.
In terms of a volume shooter, 3-point shooter, somebody who like doesn't just need somebody else to set them up, like Marco does, like Patty Mills does, like Bertens does. I wrote down Terrence Ross. You know, he too might get more than 9.2 million, but I think that's a pretty safe number for him. And so again, why him? Because, you know, defensively he doesn't bring as much. He'd probably do more better than Bellinelli, but still, he's bringing you that volume 3-point shooting where he can easily get hot off the bench and just kind of have one of those little runs. And also, he doesn't need somebody to set up for him. He has enough control. I mean, just enough of his game to take his own shots. What do you think about his name?
Yeah, so we talked about needing the volume 3-point shooter and just someone who can come in and is not afraid to take the shot. And I think, you know, The Spurs' mentality with shooters has kind of always been, if we know they can hit shots, we want them to keep taking it. I mean, you can look back at pretty much any shooter who's ever had a streaky stretch.
Gary Neal, yeah.
Yeah, Gary Neal. I mean, Danny Green, a couple seasons, where it was like, no, we just want them to keep shooting. But one of the, it's hard. I kind of have this mental block where when I think of the Spurs signing him, I think of a couple years ago in Orlando when Jonathan Simmons was there. And, and he had the hoodie on and he thought it was Jonathan Simmons. And Pop came up and that, but yeah, I mean, I think, you know, again, we're talking about needing that type of player where at least they're going to try to shoot threes and they can maybe create those shots for themselves.
Yeah. Especially like, you know, like when you play Denver, the playoffs and they take away all your spot up guys, well then you got to have somebody who can, you still get you some threes in terms of, or at least be a threat from there in terms of creating on their own. So I really don't know, you know, it's tough. I mean, honestly, if I really just want to see Lonnie get minutes in a real role. But again, we don't know how much confidence, you know, Pop would have in him in year two and, you know, how early that would take. I would just really like to see Lonnie be like the backup three, you know, next to Forbes and Patty Mills off the bench. That would be something fun to see. Because, I mean, he has so much athleticism. He has so much talent. And it's just you know, he just needs the reps and really just be tested and see what he can do. So we'll see, you know what the Spurs do in terms of free agency. You know, obviously we'll start hearing rumors as it gets closer to July 1st. The last part of this offseason discussion, Colin, is I want to talk about a possible extension for DeMar DeRozan. Now, this is a lot of this, all this information, should I say, comes from Bobby Marks of ESPN.com. So, starting July 6th, the Spurs can amend DeRozan's contract, and they can change his $27 million player option next summer and make it up start year one of a possible four-year extension. So there's some pros and cons to this this type of deal if they wanted to do this. So one of the pros is that the 2021 free agency class is very, very weak. It doesn't have a lot of stars. So let's say you don't give DeRozan the extension and he opts out next summer and he becomes an unrestricted free agent, well then here are like some of the best names that are available, the top three names: DeRozan, not in any kind of order, DeRozan, Draymond Green, Anthony Davis. Now we know Anthony Davis probably isn't coming to San Antonio. Draymond, I'm not as high on, you know, even though he's playing better in the playoffs. And so really DeRozan's basically the marquee free agent of that class if you're not getting Anthony Davis or Draymond Green. So in a way it almost makes sense for the Spurs to try to you know, get him the extension, lock him up now while they can. So how would this look for DeRozan? You know, if he agreed with the Spurs, he would start his 4-year extension, and it would start next season. He would have this extension from age 31 to 34, and he would make $149 million. Now, if he didn't want the extension and he became a free agent unrestricted next summer, and let's say he signs with a new team, he leaves them, well then a 4-year deal, same age 31 to 34, he ends up making $174.6 million. So that's a $25.5 million difference. However, if you're DeRozan, you also don't know if teams are going to give you that much, because like look at age 34, he could be making $46.7 million on somebody else's team. And I'm not sure if that's somebody else, if those teams even, if they're out there, if they even exist. So we don't know exactly where other teams gauge his value as he is going to get older. You know, as I said, next year he's going to be 31. So I feel like, you know, Mark's had a good point that, you know, San Antonio needs to approach this offseason for DeRozan like he's a free agent, an available free agent, and just try to lock him up now. He mentions how they did this with LaMarcus Aldridge, where they didn't even let LaMarcus sniff free agency. They immediately, you know, gave him a 2-year extension for $50 million. So what do you think about that, possibly San Antonio being a little bit more aggressive here in this offseason trying to lock up DeRozan?
I think it makes a ton of sense, especially if projecting out. So if they think, okay, we're going to have LaMarcus for another year or two, but the plans are probably to not bring him back or see what happens after that. I think it makes a ton of sense. The Spurs, for the first time in as long as I can remember, have a really solid young core where they have like four young players that can all grow together, and they might add one or two more in this draft. And I think if you just have a solid veteran playmaker who can kind of like lead the guard from, we've had, you know, 20 years of Spurs awesome success to, you know, holding over and tiding over and kind of growing with the younger players until maybe this new era of Spurs basketball, which we might see in 2 or 3 years once those players really come into their own. I think if you had to pick, and not to pick on Aldridge, but if you had to pick one of the two stars that would be better for ushering in that new era, it would be DeRozan, just because they have that playmaking ability and that such. And kind of like what happened with Aldridge, I remember some of the chatter around that was, if you look at the next couple off seasons, I think Zach Lowe actually had this point. If you look at the next couple off seasons and you don't think you can sign any of the marquee free agents, why not just lock up your guys? Like,
exactly.
That cap space isn't going to do any good if you're signing 8 bench players, you know, yeah, instead of a DeRozan. So I think it makes a ton of sense for them. I think it would be good for the security of it. I think that there's a little bit of kind of like, this is one more year and then DeRozan's a free agent. He just got traded. There's a little bit of an uncomfortable feeling in terms of like, he could just instantly be a free agent. Now the Spurs are kind of rebuilding some of that culture and some of that new players all over again.
Yeah.
But if they can lock him up, they can kind of know what they'll have for the next couple years.
For sure. And so like, the only reason why maybe they wouldn't do it is like, let's just say like a lot of these free agents this year, like Kevin Durant, like Kyrie Irving, all these guys, let's say they sign only 1 year deals. Well, then obviously they could become free agents that following next summer's as well. But, you know, again, I just think that the safest route for San Antonio is just to try to lock him up. So I really think that that's something to watch, you know, starting July 6th, do the Spurs, and do we get an alert, you know, San Antonio, DeMar DeRozan, you know, working on progress on a four-year extension. So that might be something to watch. If financially, it's a really good move. And also, they still have cap space. You know, Mark's mentioned how, like, let's just say they don't give DeRozan the extension, but they could have, like, around $30 million, which is this cap hole next summer. If they do give them the extension, that only goes down to like $25 million. I was looking at some of the numbers. So again, they're still going to have cap space. But again, like you just said, what are you going to do with the cap space if no one's going to come here? You know, if you're not going to get those marquee free agents, who's going to, you know, come and play? You know, what kind of player are you going to get, you know, guaranteed? So, you know, we'll see. As you know, this is just the first episode going into the offseason now. Thank you, Colin, for joining me for SpursCast episode 543. You can follow him on Twitter, SpursCast listeners, at Colin Reed PS. So again, it's at Colin Reed PS. So I'm on Twitter. SpursCast listeners, you know, it's the off season now. So we'll be, you know, the volume of episodes will kind of start going down. I'll be doing weekly again. Probably start targeting the draft a little bit more. And of course, if there's any kind of rumors on players, you know, movement kind of things, we'll definitely be sure to discuss that here on the SpursCast. So for Colin Reed, I am Paul Garcia. Thank you. Have a great day.